Hi, I'm Jeannie Becker. Welcome to Beyond Style Matters. I've spent decades working in fashion's trenches, seen the best and the worst of human style, and had the opportunity to get up close and personal with some of the world's most intriguing characters. What I've learned about truly great style is that it goes far beyond what we wear. It's about the way we move through the world. On this episode, I talk with fashion journalist Tim Blanks. The trenches of the fashion world can be a pretty lonely place, especially when you're a TV reporter with a camera crew in tow. Covering the scene, from getting the right sound bites from editors to nabbing the front row celebrities to scoring a great interview with a star designer, is never as easy as it may seem. It's survival of the fittest, and anyone fighting to get the same type of material as you are is considered a bit of a rival. That's where Tim Blanks comes in. For 15 of the 27 years that I hosted fashion television, Tim was hosting the CBC-produced Fashion File, that other international fashion magazine show that also helped revolutionize the industry and inform captive audiences that could never get enough fashion. While our approaches were definitely different, Tim and I were friendly rivals, you might say, going through the same sorts of motions season after season, working our butts off and often comparing notes, sometimes at martini-drenched dinners late into the night in the world's fashion capitals. While our styles of reportage were truly disparate, we both had a lot of heart, and I've always had the utmost respect for Tim and all of his intellectual savvy. A native of New Zealand, Tim lived in London and New York before moving to Canada, where he was the editor-in-chief of Toronto Life fashion magazine. After Fashion File, he went on to work for Condé Nast's Style.com, and in 2015, he became editor-at-large for the revered Business of Fashion. Tim, who currently resides in London, is a multi-award-winning journalist, critic, and author with numerous fashion books to his credit. He's currently working on one about Versace. Tim's wry sense of humor and big brain are just two of the many reasons I adore him. And of course, it's always a welcome blessing to have a battle buddy to reminisce with. Tim Blanks, what an absolute,
Jeannie Becker.
What an absolute pleasure to have you on this episode of Style Matters, and it's so surreal. It is so freaking surreal. I have been so looking forward to this, except I have to be totally transparent and say with a little kind of trepidation, a little, I don't know, like I've interviewed a gazillion people in my day, but then when it comes to you, it's like a whole other thing. And I know I've talked to you in the field, you know, shoving a mic in your face for a 10-second soundbite, but this is different.
Jeannie, we're friends. For goodness sake, we've known each other for 40 years.
I know. But, you know, I hold you in such high esteem.
Well, listen, we'll get into talking about this. But, you know, in the world of fashion, you and I are like the mama bear and papa bear of a whole lot of people who are working in the industry now, you know?
Yeah. And actually, sometimes I feel a little daunted by that, because I think we created a monster. I mean, we opened a window onto this glamorous world, and so many kids thought, yeah, I want to get in there. And now they're all coming out of the fashion schools in droves, and many who have already, and some, you know, who got out at just the right time and built incredible careers for themselves. But I think there are a lot of people now that are going to be disillusioned about what this industry can offer them.
I don't know. It's funny that we're having this conversation today, because I'm not surprised. I guess I'm impressed by how pragmatic everybody is, that I don't think anybody comes into fashion expecting they're going to build a multi-million dollar business anymore. And when people ask me what my advice is, I say, well, you do it because you love it. You do it because it's a vocation. You do it because it's satisfying for you in some way. I mean, living and working in London, where so many British designers. In British fashion has never been characterized by hugely, you know, financially successful businesses. It's always been creative, radical, outliers, iconoclasts. And, you know, we just had this virtual fashion, these virtual fashion weeks. And it was so interesting to see the people who coped with it best, I thought. You know, young designers who have a sort of a native ingenuity and are really looking to make statements, social, political, whatever. You know, it is a very different world. It's going to be an incredibly different world post-COVID. And I think that the designers who approach this different world in a different way will do well.
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, okay. I think the talent, you know, has been there, is there, will always be there. And especially coming out of a hotbed like London, which is always just, you know, taken everything to a whole other level. At the end of the day, unless you've got someone backing you, you know, unless your parents are investing in your label, I don't know how you pay the rent on your studio. I mean, just that simple. It's just, it seems like a real luxury to want to do that. I mean, unless you're just going to somehow, you know, work for somebody else and just get a gig in fashion. But I think those gigs are disappearing as well. I don't know. I hate to be that cynical about it.
You know, something that's very strong in this time, in this sort of pandemic, the time of the pandemic and what's coming afterwards, is that fashion, in my ideal world, fashion is restored as a private pleasure. And the whole notion of doing it all for show and doing it all for social media and for social media and for Instagram likes and things is going to change. And already you're hearing, you know, people when you're locked down in your bubble and you can't be out there and, you know, whatever, showing off to the world. I'm hearing about people getting very dressed up for little dinners and things the way it used to be, you know, like when women would wear fantastic couture dresses and amazing jewelry to go for dinner with their friends. And it wasn't about somebody taking a photo to put it on social media. And fashion might return to that kind of intimacy and that kind of humanity in a way that you dress for yourself. You don't dress for, you know, 20 million Instagram followers.
Yeah. But there are a lot of people now who are dressing for themselves in sweatsuits, you know, track pants and, you know, underpants on the bottom of their suit jackets on Zoom. Dressing for themselves.
I always have. I mean, I've always dressed like that. Then that's fine. I mean, everything's fine.
I don't think a lot of people know that much about your early beginnings. And okay, you're from New Zealand, which I always found was fascinating too, because that other woman with the fashion show, Elsa Clench, was also from New Zealand, right?
She was from Tasmania.
Oh, well then, even more exotic.
Where Errol Flynn came from.
That part of the world. I mean, what makes a kid growing? I want to know what it was like for you growing up as a kid in that part of the world and when you have that urge to bust out.
I mean, growing up in that part of the world, you're at the beach before school, you're at the beach after school. I mean, I love swimming. I wasn't a particularly athletic kid. I didn't do any of the rugby or all those cricket, all those things that my parents tried, but it didn't work. No, I was very academic and I was very in my own head and I was very into music and my own kind of music. I mean, all my school mates were listening to The Doors and Jimi Hendrix and things like that. And I was listening to Tyrannosaurus Rex and Fairport Convention. But I graduated from university when I was quite young and my immediate impulse was to go overseas to do my postgrad work. And so I did. I was obsessed with David Bowie. I went to England, obviously, with imagining that I would see David Bowie or whatever. I'm sure you'd appreciate this because you love music as much as I do. But, you know, when I was coming off the plane at Heathrow, going down the walkway, to go, Robert Plant was walking towards me. So the first person I saw when I arrived in England was Robert Plant. And I thought, yes, this is why I'm here. Oh. Yeah, so that, I mean, that was
so why. This was mid-70s?
This was 74.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's how I ended up in England. The fashion thing probably, well, the fashion thing probably happened around music, I guess, around the Velvet Underground, around, but fashion would come to me through something like Life magazine. I don't think I would ever have seen a Vogue, but that's how I became aware of style, I guess, more than fashion. And you'd see a picture of Lou Reed at the factory and it would just look incredible. You know, he would just look so incredible and you'd think, yes, one day. And basically, as soon as I could, I followed that dream. Of course, the dream turned into a complete nightmare, and it took a long, long time for me to stabilize myself in the world. And I guess that's how I ended up in Toronto in 1978.
What brought you to Toronto?
I'd be really dramatic and say a woman. I moved to Toronto with a friend of mine from London who needed to get out of London in a hurry, and she had a Canadian passport, coincidentally, so we went to Canada.
And what'd you think of Canada when you got here?
I was so ignorant. I mean, I could say that there was a moment where I thought we were on the ocean. I mean, I'm not that stupid, but we moved to New York quite quickly. And then New York in 1978 was so hard and bankrupt and violent. I got mugged, I think, 3 times, even though I was obviously a penniless kind of waif. And then somebody got thrown out of the apartment building behind us and lay in the air shaft groaning all night long. And then I thought, that's it, we're out of here. So we ended up back in Toronto. Then, you know, Toronto life happened. Life in Toronto and Toronto life.
Toronto Life magazine, the fashion magazine that you edited.
Fashion File, and you were doing it, and then you were doing F Fashion Television. And you know, there's one interesting, I can ask you this question because I've always wondered, Toronto, Canada, every newspaper had a fashion supplement or major fashion coverage. And you and I ended up being responsible for 2 of the 3 major global fashion television shows. How did Toronto end up being the epicenter of fashion on television?
Well, I mean, I always thought about Canada in general and why so many Canadians have gone on to become great international journalists. Too, is that we were never that caught up in the hype. I think there's a reflective kind of quality about Canadian people. You know, I mean, the fact is, I don't know. Do you think of yourself as Canadian anymore?
I never ever thought of myself as Canadian, but I don't know what I think of myself as. But I left New Zealand in 1974, so I always call myself a New Zealander. But really, I don't know. Canada made me what I am. I mean, more than anything, more than any other country. I wasn't living in Toronto when I was doing Fashion File.
Yeah, but you were doing it for the CBC, which was a Canadian.
Yes, for the CBC.
And your producers were Canadian and the crew and the production facility. Yeah, which is interesting. I mean, for me, obviously, it was a natural progression. And the great visionary, Moses Neimer, you know, had the idea of, you know, bringing that kind of electricity to the folks out there via the music scene first. And then that just the natural progression. I mean, just like you say, okay, so why did you decide to really go down that fashion road and not be a music critic?
I mean, the first magazine job I ever had in Auckland was a music magazine. And when I went to London in 1974, I got lots of interviews with people saying I was writing for this. The magazine was called Hot Licks. In those days, you could literally call up anybody and say, I want to interview you. Oh, what's it for? Hot Licks in New Zealand, New Zealand's premier music magazine, not that New Zealand had any music. And you could literally get anybody. I think, you know, everybody always says that John Lennon's murder changed. Ooh, I don't know, like maybe the Manson murders changed Hollywood's open door hospitality policy. Lennon's murder kind of changed it with from the music industry. But honestly, in those days, I could call anybody up and I didn't get David Bowie, but everybody else. And when I went to Toronto, I was initially working for, you know, Nelvana, the animated film company.
Absolutely, Nelvana, yes.
I worked in the paint room at Nelvana.
What, like doing Care Bears?
I did Strawberry Shortcake and Inspector Gadget. And when I left Nelvana, I was freelancing. Suddenly everybody wanted to hire me. I don't know why, but after a little bit of freelancing, I wanted a full-time job. So it just so happened that the only magazine that offered me a full-time job was Toronto Life Fashion. Yeah. So in a way, me working in fashion, that's how accidental it was.
Yeah.
that was actually how I came to work in fashion. It was complete accident.
Yeah, you know? And same with me. I mean, I really found myself in fashion, always loved it, but it was just like, oh, there's an opportunity to do a fashion video show at City TV. And I was, you know, the rock and roll scene was just getting a little tired for me. And I thought, okay, the next big thing. All right, so here we are. I mean, I started with fashion television in 85. I think
Do you know what inspired that, though? Because that was pretty visionary in 1985.
What happened was that designers, a very few of them, a very small handful of them, including Norma Kamali, Ralph Lauren, Electra Cassidy, I don't know if you remember, making these fashion videos, that fashion videos would become like music videos and do for the industry what music videos had done for the music industry. But there were no platforms for these. And also they became dated very quickly. So Moses came to myself and I think Daniel Richler at the time, I was doing the new music. And he said, you know, here, we've got these great videos, like just put them on, you know, put them on the new music because we don't have any place to put them. And I was like, oh, great, fashion videos. We should do that. But of course, it didn't really feel right. And then Jay Levine, who was a young producer in the promotions department at City TV, decided that, well, you know, this is really sexy stuff. You know, maybe we could just do a fashion video show and we'll get like a gorgeous model to host it. And it'll just be really, you know, all about sex and visuals. And when I heard about this, I thought, well, hold on a minute. I really love fashion. And I grew up in the 60s and, you know, I wore go-go boots and I should be the one doing this. I've paid my dues. I'm sick of music. Let's go on to fashion. And they really didn't want me to do it, but I kicked and screamed and eventually they said, okay, fine, you could do the pilot. And then I said, let's do with the designers what we did with the Rock and Rollers. Let's interview them and go into the studio with them and go behind the scenes with them. And at first they said, no, we don't want any talking heads. We just want sexy fashion. But after the first pilot, they said, you know, we could do with some more meat. So, okay. And then we went to New York and did a story with the Betsy Johnson and Bob Mackie. And, you know, that's sort of how the whole thing snowballed.
Yeah.
And then it was a few years later, it was 89. Then you took it to a whole other level because you were so smart and educated. You saw it through much more of an intellectual lens. And truly, you were the one that was embraced by the fashion crowd in a way that I don't think I ever was. And when I say the fashion crowd, I mean the print people. I think the print people hated fashion on television. Did you feel that at all?
Thing for me, I remember you used to say to me, though, I could never ask the questions you asked because my audience just isn't interested in those subjects. And it's true. I mean, you have a conversation with, we were having conversations. I mean, for me, I remember it was a funny situation because my feeling, I never wanted to be on air. I thought that this was about giving these people a forum and they'd never had one. You know, I want to hear what they have to say. I don't want to be the sort of person dancing around in front of obscuring whatever interesting stuff might be going on, the models or the designers or the hair, the makeup people, whatever. Let's hear them.
And yeah, so interesting. But you had to hone other skills in order to do your show, as I had to hone other skills.
Yeah, absolutely.
How much did I even really know about fashion? I mean, I didn't really. I was learning it as I went along, you know, as my viewers were learning it. You know, we were all learning it together, growing up together in that way. But you had such a great editorial point of view. I mean, you were a bona fide fashion editor. You really understood fashion. You could critique it in a way that I didn't even want to. You know, I couldn't.
Are you sure that that didn't kind of come afterwards? I mean, to me, interviewing somebody was really about having a conversation, listening to what they were saying and responding to what they were saying and whatever they were saying, picking up on it and not going in with like, oh, why is it blue? Why are their boots? Why are their, you know, why are your earrings gold or whatever? So probably not. I don't know if I was so much more editorial as I was sort of conversational. And the whole critiquing thing, I mean, if I ever come across an old-fashioned file now because somebody posts it online or something, it sounds like I'm on helium when I'm speaking. You know, as I've aged, my voice is like it's been aged in an oak cask or something. But we didn't re-editorialize that much on Fashion File. And if there was commentary, hopefully the commentary was weighed towards the interviewees rather than the interviewer. Mm-hmm. I mean, it will be the golden era of fashion in our time when you could get Alexander McQueen for an hour at the beginning of his career. Or John Galliano would, you know, there was so Christian Lacroix.
Or getting into those parties. I remember going to a party with Donatella Versace through a party in Paris, and P. Diddy was there DJing, and like, whoa. We were just in the eye of the storm, Tim. We were in the
You got
eye.
Invited to those things. I didn't.
Oh, come on.
I didn't.
There's no way I got an invitation that you would.
You did. I didn't. It's a funny thing. You know, I worked with Nicole Phelps at style.com, and admittedly, the reason why we didn't go to parties was because we were working all night reviewing shows. But mm-hmm. I said to her once, we are going to leave the industry and we're never going to know what it was like to go to dinners and parties and things. Everybody that we were friendly with was out all night and we were in our hotel. Now, I did. The thing is, I didn't much care that I didn't get invited to swanky things. I didn't see Fashion File because it wasn't on in England. So I never saw it. I had no idea who was watching it. I mean, I could go to Brazil on holiday or something and people would be like, oh my God, we love your TV show. And I'd be like, well, I haven't seen it. What's it like? I'm being naive there because they did send it to me and I didn't always watch it. You know, it kind of happened outside me. It really did. It was like that was something so different. And then it did sort of, towards the end, there was a sense of how it was playing in people's lives, that people were more and more interested in fashion and they had very few vehicles to experience fashion. And one was you, one was me. And that's why you have people like Christopher Kane saying their fashion education was watching you. Or somebody like Karolina Kurkova saying to me the reason why she became a model was because she watched Fashion File in the Czech Republic growing up, you know, and that's what she wanted to do.
But, you know, really, Tim, I just go back to all those times post-shows lining up for the, really, sometimes it was a bit of a scrum there, but like waiting for the second that the PR person, and I think those PR people, you know, God bless some of them, but some of them were just the gatekeepers from hell. I mean, they were so mean and they made me cry several times when you're next, or Tim before Jeannie, or Jeannie's before Tim. Usually, you know, it was pretty cool. It was like you or I would be the first ones to get the interview with Galliano or with Carl, or, you know, I mean, that was pretty incredible.
Do you remember when there weren't PR people? Do you remember at the beginning when there weren't PR people? And you would go backstage and you might be the only camera crew there.
Totally.
And there'd be no photographers. And then that supermodel thing happened. And suddenly it went from being three photographers backstage to 300 photographers. And I really wanted to tap people on the shoulder and say, is there film in that camera?
Every great conversation needs a pause, so this is the perfect time to talk to you about our sponsor, TSC, who, without their support, this podcast wouldn't be possible. Now, as you might know, I've covered the catwalks of Paris, Milan, New York, and London. And so you might ask, why have I partnered with a retailer like TSC, today's shopping choice? Well, I believe great fashion should be accessible to everyone. And TSC.ca is home to some amazing designers, wonderful Canadians like Brian Bailey, Kim Newport Mimran of Pink Tartan fame, and Hillary McMillan, as well as quality brands like Lamarck and Ron White Shoes. It's one-stop shopping for everything you need to make your own style statement. And of course, TSC offers so much more than mere fashion. Shop TSC.ca and discover some great brands at some great prices.
Now, after that crazy frenzy, which was, you know, totally the age of excess, things started to spin in a whole other direction with the advent of the bloggers. Fashion changed dramatically for me, or my job in the fashion scene, let's call it, or my take on what we were doing changed dramatically. One day, and I'll tell you when that was, after you tell me your day, or if there was a day, or was there a time when you just realized, like, you know, mon Dieu, this is really coming to a crashing halt and we're going to go into another direction now?
Well, it was when style.com offered me a job. Really simple. I went to Milan with Jamie Palo, who was running style.com. They were starting men.style.com. This was, you know, there was vision there, because the whole story of how style.com came into being is such an interesting one. But it was really all about Condé Nast being so unsure of this interweb thing. And, you know, maybe it's a phase and we'd better not kind of sully our major properties, Vogue and GQ, by attaching them to anything interwebby, just in case it all goes belly up. So we'll start this thing called style.com. And if it goes wrong, we haven't lost anything. And that's bold strokes for that, I reckon. That's my interpretation of it. But anyway, style.com did very well and they started men.style. And I met Jamie Palo. Sarah Moa introduced us, who was style.com's main writer, main critic. And we did a dummy run in Milan during one men's season where I would review shows just to see if I could do it. And it just felt, it was instantly something I enjoyed just so much. So much more, because it was just utterly engaging, you know, instantly for me to be writing about. Nobody else had done that in that way. Mm-hmm. Style.com pioneered that kind of coverage, for better or worse. And it was just exciting to feel that it actually was something, another new thing, you know, because I did Fashion File for a long time. I think I did Fashion File for about 15 years. How long did you do?
27.
Oh,
27 years, darling. Well, for me, it changed the day Tavi Gevinson sat in front of me at a Chanel show. This little girl whose father had brought her to the show. Stephen Jones had designed this fantastic papier-mâché, you know, hat for her, this big bow. And she sat in front of me. And then I introduced her to Carl, you know, at the end of the show. And he was, you know, quite taken with her because she was the new curiosity, this little blogger from the suburbs of Chicago, wherever she was from. Like, fashion should be ageless. I mean, don't you feel, Tim, that fashion keeps you young? I mean, I certainly do. Do you feel that?
I don't think it's a question of keeping you young, but I just think if you stay interested in fashion, it tends to mean you're interested in a lot of other things. You stay interested in music and movies and books, and you are culturally engaged. And so I don't think it's necessarily, I think maybe attitudinally, it keeps you, I think it keeps you curious. And the thing that keeps, well, if anything keeps you young, it's curiosity. I'm sure you are as engaged by everything you always were engaged by. I mean, I probably listen to more music now than I have for years and years.
I want to talk to you about the role of the critic in fashion, because you indeed are one of the world's top fashion critics. I never saw myself in the role of a critic. I've never criticized in that way. I was all about celebrating fashion. And while I spent time analyzing it, perhaps, and delighted in that particular challenge, I never went at it in the way that you have. And you know, have done it so well, sometimes much to the dismay of the designer himself or herself. A case in point, a couple of years ago, you reviewed a Jean-Paul Gaultier collection, and it really kind of shattered him. He was very upset by that. So I'm interested in, you know, how that kind of thing makes you feel, and just your feelings in general about the role of the critic.
I've never thought of myself as particularly critical. I mean, I think about when I write about fashion, when I write about a fashion show, I always wanted to give a sense of what it's like to be sitting in the show. So that's why it became a joke. I got a lot of ribbing. People say, you always write about the music. And I would say, you know what I'm writing about? And you know, do you ever do re-sees? Do you go back and look at the collection in the showroom? And I say, no, I'm writing about the show. I'm reviewing a show because that is what the designer wants me to see of his or her collection. And that's if, you know, it's like John Galliano talking about the show being the parfum of the collection. So that's why I reviewed fashion shows like I would review a rock concert or a movie. And that would be the hair, the makeup, the music, the set, the whatever was going on, the ambience. And I just don't think there were really many other people doing that. I mean, I suppose I've been banned from shows. I'm still banned from two huge shows, actually. I think I'm banned in perpetuity.
From which ones can you say?
Oh, I'm banned from Dolce & Gabbana and I'm banned from Celine.
The nerve.
And I've been banned from a lot of other ones over the years.
Talking about the shows, Tim, where do you think that's going? I mean, that's like a burning question for a lot of people, and especially those that missed out on the incredible theatrical extravaganzas.
Yeah. Well, that's not coming
back.
I mean, I know Chanel and Dior and Valentino and Vuitton did big, well, Vuitton's was a sort of combination of virtual and digital and, you know, real life, so on. But I know that those big houses still feel the need to do those big shows. But I thought what was extremely interesting this season, which was virtual, mostly virtual, is how quickly people had adjusted. 6 months ago, Dries Van Noten was saying, I cannot imagine not doing a fashion show. And then what he did this time, which was fully realized, an incredible kind of insight into his creative process. Same with John Galliano's film with Nick Knight for Maison Margiela. Incredible insight into his creative process. And both of them responsible for amazing fashion shows, mm-hmm. said, this wasn't so bad.
Yeah.
And, you know, there won't be shows in January. There won't be shows in March. So this is going to be what we've just seen will be even more sophisticated. And, you know, if shows come back, they won't be the way that they were. When shows come back, I should say, if short course shows are going to come back, because, you know, a fashion show is like a watering hole for the industry. It's where everybody gathers and, you know, chit chat and gossip. And, you know, there's a conversation about maybe this person's good for that job and next minute they've got it. But I've had such a good time sitting here in my library with my laptop, experiencing everything, and then being able to experience it again, and then being able to experience in a different way. It's a completely different way of experiencing fashion, and as opposed to sitting in a row of seats and then right jumping in the car and going to another one, and then another one, and then another one, and is existing in this state of perpetual overload and exhaustion and delicious lunches and dinners and way too much alcohol. This has been just a completely different experience, but a valid one. I would have 6 months ago said something very different, but now I'm completely intrigued by what happens next. I'm up for it. Whatever. I would say I'm guardedly optimistic, and I'm a naturally very pessimistic person. I still think we're in the middle of the pandemic, we're maybe at the beginning of the pandemic for all I know. So we still don't know how hard it's going to hit the industry. We have a pretty good idea. There's been hideous projections about, you know, 75% of design businesses going bankrupt. We're already seeing shops closing all over the place. We're seeing the way people shop is changing. And I think in my optimism, thinking that, you know, this virtual thing has made everything much more intimate and in a funny way, much more human. You feel like you're connecting with fashion in a very different way, in a much more direct way. And it's really odd because it's obviously you're looking at it in a screen, but that human element, paradoxically, the sort of celebration of craft. Why do people become designers? That they're in love with making things. This celebration of the make, you know, and the stories that will be told. It's not just who designs the clothes, it's who makes the fabric, who does the embroidery, all these. These are the stories, I think, that we'll hear more and more and more. And it's using this format, you know, the screen, as a new mode of engagement. That was a very long answer to your question, but anyway.
Tim, what are you going to miss the most about those old glory days of fashion? You called it the golden age? I mean, I know you touched on now saying, oh, it's just so much running around and the hassle of it. And the
You know, it's hindsight is a beast. You know, we used to season after season when you and I, you know, talking about lining up to do interviews and how humiliating it was a lot of the time and how exhausting it was and how going to McQueen shows season after season or Galliano shows, you know, in the end, we were horribly spoiled. And I never walked out of every Alexander McQueen show I ever saw thinking, wow, that was a kind of life-changing experience. So I'm looking at them now and I'm thinking, I can't even believe I was there. It seems so wonderful. Mm-hmm. And I would think, what a spoiled little brat I was. I was like, oh, McQueen, I've got to go to something else, you know? Or what were the other, Goche shows in those days? I mean, I have to say that at the time, those things were amazing to me. At the time, there were Galliano things that were just phenomenal. And I was thinking, I feel so lucky to be here. I don't care if I'm standing at the back or whatever. I feel so privileged to see these things. But it was all the stuff around them, that kind of, you know, all the way that we were treated, because we weren't often treated particularly well. We were like cattle.
Oh, terribly. Yeah, like second-class citizens, for sure.
Yeah, maybe third class, you know. We didn't talk about who was the worst person for sound bites in all our years of being in the trenches.
Oh, all right. You want to throw that out? Tell me who. Who was your worst?
You first.
Well, one thing I have to say, okay, I know people love him a lot and he's like a gorgeous guy and he's been, you know, in the news lately. Lenny Kravitz did a really crappy thing to me once, a really mean thing to me. I was at a fashion show. I can't remember whose show it was. And there was Lenny Kravitz sitting in the front row and he was on his phone, you know, and I thought, okay, well, you know, I'm just going to be nice. And I'm just going to hang around, kind of dance around him just so, you know, I mean, no, why the hell would a celebrity come to a fashion show where there's tons of media and sit in the front row and not expect to be approached for something? I mean, they should, but that's fine. You know, a lot of them were just so infuriating. But I went over to Lenny Kravitz and he certainly saw me standing there with my cameraman, like wanting, and I'm sure that the person on the other end of the line from him probably had hung up on him like minutes ago. But he just kept pretending that he was on the other line, not wanting to talk to me, not wanting to actually reject me outright from a soundbite. But just, it was, like you said earlier, so dehumanizing, so humiliating. And all I wanted was, like, you know, a 5-second soundbite. And he just pretended that he was too busy to talk to me. And I must have stood there for about 10 minutes. And then, the show was going to start. I had to leave. And I just felt like such a jerk. Meanwhile, there we were making them household names, or helping to anyway.
Pumping them into millions and millions and millions. Well, it wasn't the designers. That was when PR, the power of the PR person, mm-hmm. kicked off. What stands out for us looking back is these frozen moments. I would still say the 90s were the golden era, just because from the very beginning with Christian Lacroix, through the supermodels, through Helmut Lang and Tom Ford, and, you know, right up to the very end of the decade, there was so much. It was so rich, and everybody was working at full tilt. Social media and the industrialization of luxury and all those things hadn't really, they'd kicked off, but they hadn't really begun to flatten things out. And also it was still very diverse and still very celebratory. I feel like, well, you asked me how I feel about living through that time. I'm so grateful. I feel so privileged. And I like it that kids seem really to want to hear about that. Nobody my age is remotely interested in what was ever remotely interested in what I did. Nobody. None of my friends, if I was away for 6 weeks, nobody said, where have you been? You know, it was just a whole weird thing that it was another world. I mean, I actually, times I can't believe it even happened, to be honest.
Yeah, it was quite a mighty and magical dream. And I'm so with you, Tim. I'm just so happy to know that you're on the planet. I adore you. Thank you for being out there and for being the big brain that you are and the big heart that you are. Thank you for being on this episode of Beyond Style Matters. Talk soon.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening. To see video versions of the podcasts, check out tse.ca/stylematters. You can watch Style Matters Thursday on TSE or on the tse.ca website. New episodes of Beyond Style Matters will be coming at you every Monday. Till next time, I'm Jeannie Becker.